Okay, so in this lecture we're going to be looking rather more at development and types of historiography in the modern world and thinking about the Gospels in the light of that. Modern historiography in the West began with the historical revolution of the early 19th century. And what was new about that was really the concept of history as a rigorous science with a scientific methodology for arriving at the objective truth. I'll say more about that in a moment. But in other ways, 19th century history, what we might call the traditional modernist paradigm of history, was strikingly continuous with ancient historiography. The tradition of Thucydides, Polybius, Livy, and the rest. And among these continuities was the definition of history as political history from above, the history of the great rulers and generals who were thought to have shaped history. As you saw in my second lecture, the history from below approach that developed in the 1960s was a major departure from this, and indeed modern historiography more generally has developed in many directions quite different from the modernist paradigm of political history from above. But we've also seen in the last lecture that whereas ancient historiography was almost exclusively that of political history from above, the New Testament Gospels are rather more like history from below. So the notion is beginning to take shape that perhaps the Gospels, in their differences from ancient historiography, accord better with some of the new ways of thinking about history and historical practice in the last half century than they do with either the ancient paradigm or the modernist paradigm. This is no doubt a daring thesis, and I stress that I'm speaking only of some of the new directions in historiography, and I'm suggesting no more than that the Gospels come closer to these than they do to the traditional paradigm. To claim more than that would undoubtedly be to invite the charge of anachronism, and I repeat what I said in the second lecture, I think, that my use of these recent approaches to history I use as a heuristic enterprise, that is, a way of looking for things that are there in the Gospels that we may not have paid enough attention to. Now, I'm going to try and sketch something of what has happened in the modern historical tradition since the 19th century. This will obviously have to be very brief and schematic. I shall do this in two parts, and between those two parts, I shall place what is a major part of this last lecture, a discussion of microhistory and the Gospels as microhistory. And then we'll go on to some postmodern stuff towards the end. Well then, first, the first part of my brief survey of modern and postmodern history. A useful way to think of this, I suggest, is to make a distinction between historiography, which is what historians do, and philosophy of history, meaning ideas about the nature of history and of historiography. The two are, of course, closely related, but not always so closely as one might imagine, because a lot of historians are just very practical, pragmatic people who just get on with doing the same thing and don't really think much about the theories. However, the modernist paradigm of historiography, to begin with, had two sides to it. One of these was a view of the proper subject matter of history, what I've called political history from above. And the reason this was regarded as the proper subject in early 19th century pioneers of this paradigm, especially the famous Leopold von Ranke, was because the nation state, this is different from the ancient world, of course, the nation state in the 19th century seemed to be the dominant reality of the historical process. The other side to the modernist paradigm that we need to notice was the epistemological one. Modernist history shared with the Enlightenment in general an optimistic epistemological realism. In other words, by using a rigorous methodology, historians would be able to discover and describe the objective truth of history. What actually happened? It's von Ranke's famous phrase. What actually happened back there then? We'll take up that epistemological aspect again later, because it's what the postmodernists have very much questioned, but that's the aspect, that's the attitude of modernist paradigm to it. Now, the first development from the definition of history as political history from above was the social science history that developed in the 20th century. This was methodologically a further step in the attempt to make history a science like the natural sciences. The quantitative and analytical methods of economics and sociology were to enable the historian to discover the determinative forces in complex historical process. The great men who directed history according to the 19th century view were now replaced by the impersonal forces of economic and social trends. Thus, the subject matter of history extended from the political to encompass society, society studied, as it were, en masse. We already know about the next development, which is history from below, but notice that by contrast with that impersonal sort of image of how history happens, it's not what people do, it's what kind of happens on a large impersonal scale. History from below, as we've seen, tried to restore agency in history to ordinary people. So not just the ruling elite, but nor just the impersonal forces, but the common people themselves played a part in making their own history. So in effect, the scope of history again extended from politics and society to popular culture. Part of the same sort of development was women's history. Similarly, beginning in the 1960s, an attempt to recover aspects of history that had been neglected by primarily male historians, and also the histories of other minority groups which began to be written in that period. And microhistory, which I'll say more in a moment, also fits quite well into that development of various kinds of history from below. Now, alongside those developments in historiography, what historians were actually doing runs the history of ideas about history. And here we must introduce the great modern meta-narratives that dominated Western culture from the Enlightenment to at least the mid-20th century. Arguably, they're still very influential. In one way or another, these grand narratives, meta-narratives, offered a grand interpretation of the whole course of history as a coherent development towards a foreseeable goal. At least the history of the modern age could be seen to be moving in a clear direction. History seemed to be one thing, history with a capital H, with a coherent development that can be plotted and understood and explained and even predicted. These ideas about history are often called historicism. In one way or another, even in their Marxist forms, these progressivist meta-narratives assumed that modern Western history is in the vanguard of the whole of history, on the way to some kind of rational utopia. Although strictly speaking mythical, the meta-narratives were rationalist. In other words, the people who propounded these believed in the scientific observation of laws of history that could be understood, analogous to the laws of Darwinian evolution that offered so attractive an analogy at that period from one of the natural sciences. The economic and sociological approaches to history, as I've mentioned, fell broadly within this progressivist outlook. They assumed that what they were doing was plotting the movement of history in a definite observable direction. History is steadily getting more democratic, you know, would be one way of looking at it, for example. And History from Below was also part of this trend in that the people like E.P. Thompson and Andrew Day were also caught up in a sense of history as kind of going somewhere. It was the working classes, it was a sort of semi-Marxist view of it. They were very revisionist in terms of Marxism, but they still have this sense that history is going somewhere, and the historian is kind of plotting how that happens, what the grand design is. However, meta-narratives began to be perceived with growing incredulity or disillusionment in the mid-20th century, the period of Nazism, the Holocaust, Stalinism, and all the other horrors of 20th century history, through very serious doubt on this kind of optimistic, progressivist view of what was happening in history. And the idea of a single historical process moving in some intelligible way towards a definite and single goal came to be seen as illusory by many people. History fragmented. And the intelligibility of history, the idea that there is a process whose laws we can discover and follow, along with the idea that we are able, through rational understanding of the process, to control it and further it, became suspect. This incredulity towards meta-narratives is usually credited to the postmodern philosophers. But it's worth noting that others, such as Karl Popper, anticipated it. Postmodernism takes the critique further by seeing the modern meta-narrative not only in its totalitarian forms, but in all forms, even in its liberal progressive forms, as actually an ideology of oppression, legitimizing the West's exploitation of the rest of the world. Well, postmodernism leads us into back to the epistemological issue, postmodernism's most distinctive challenge to the whole historical enterprise was the epistemological one, and I'll come back to that later. For the moment, let's take a break from the survey and turn to microhistory. The best known examples of microhistory are two studies in European history written in the mid-70s. Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie's book called Montaigu, Catholics and Cathars in a French Village, 1294 to 1324. And Carlo Ginzburg's The Cheese and the Worms, the Cosmos of a 16th Century Miller. Both of these books, especially Ginzburg's Cheese and the Worms, proved very popular with ordinary readers. Both of these authors exploited rather unusual cases in which the views of ordinary people of the medieval and early modern period were accessible at length and in something close to their original words. Their sources are Inquisition registers that record quite meticulously the words of defendants and witnesses. So they put the historian of those centuries in something approaching the position of the modern oral historian who can access the ideas and experiences of ordinary people directly. In the case of Montaigu, it's a large number of peasants living in a small area of southern France in the early 14th century. But Cheese and the Worms focuses on the idiosyncratic ideas of just one individual, a miller in a village of northeastern Italy, who was interviewed at length by the Inquisition before eventually being executed in 1600. The appeal of this, I think, was just how bizarre and creative this guy's view of the world was. The book, The Cheese and the Worms, takes its title from this miller's picture of the origins of the world when he compared it with the familiar peasant experience of cheese making. The earth was formed, he contended, when the pre-existent ocean curdled like milk in to form cheese. And then the angels, apparently including God, appeared like worms in the cheese, a sort of spontaneous generation of life from inanimate matter. Intriguing, but, well, just one eccentric miller's view of the world. The author of The Cheese and the Worms, Carlo Ginzburg, is the best known of a group of Italian historians who in the 1970s and 80s evolved this historiographical movement that they called microhistory. And some other historians outside Italy were moving in the same direction and classed in the same sort of category by observers. One commentator in 2002 was able to say that microhistory is the flagship of contemporary social historians. Microhistory is a reduction of scale, narrowing the historian's focus to a specific small social group. But the reduction of scale is not meant simply to make it possible to observe the same things at micro level that one can perceive at macro level. The micro studies are not a mere case, are not to be mere case histories illustrating what macro history already knew perfectly well. The rationale for micro history is that some things at the micro level one will see. One will see different things at the micro level, things that one misses if one is working at the macro level of the big historical developments. Another of the Italian microhistorians says the unifying principle of all microhistorical research is the belief that microscopic observation will reveal factors previously unnoticed. Phenomena previously considered to be sufficiently described and understood assume completely new meanings by altering the scale of observation. So these microhistorical studies were not examples for macrohistory. They were experiments in search of what can only be seen at the micro level. In particular, what from the macro historical perspective seem to be anomalous or discontinuous elements in history. Almost a patron saint of the Italian micro historians is Sherlock Holmes, because his technique consisted in observing trifles that could turn out to be important. Never trust to general impressions, my boy, he says to Watson, but concentrate yourself upon the details. The micro historians also had a kind of motto. This is rather suggestive for our own enterprise of understanding the Gospels as history. It is a saying of the novelist Gustave Flaubert, God is in the detail. Surely a theologically preferable saying to its English variant, the devil is in the detail. Microhistory can be, and has been, applied to the elite. But much more frequently, it is applied to the ordinary people of history. And this has been Ginzburg's prime concern. Edward Muir, introducing a volume of essays from this school of writers, instances examples of the little people, usually ignored by history, but appearing in these essays. He quotes, a charlatan distiller, the anonymous pillagers of ecclesiastical property, an accused witch, peasants who had disturbing visions, two Jews who destroyed Christian images on their houses, and unwed mothers who sought aid in urban hospitals. I cite that list because, allowing for the differences of historical period, it rather resembles my charts of the ordinary and poor people who appear in the Gospels. Like the historians from below, there's also a concern for the agency of such ordinary people, reflecting both on individuals but also the social interactions of relatively small groups. And the contention is that this is where most of history really happens. You want to see history happening, you have to go to this micro level, the small groups of people, the segments of society, and see what's kind of happening on the ground. A search, I'm quoting again one of these historians, the search for a more realistic description of human behaviour in the world that recognises humanity's relative freedom beyond, though not outside, the constraints of prescriptive and oppressive normative systems. So here again you've got a coherence, if you like, with history from below in the restoration of human agency and not submission to impersonal forces. It's not impersonal forces. Of course, they have an influence, but they're not the sole makers of history. Real people that you can find at the ground level, if you look, are the people who also make history. Now, undoubtedly, disillusionment with the grand meta-narratives, Marxism and liberal progressivism, which understood progress to be happening on a big scale by laws of history and so forth, undoubtedly there's a strong reaction against all that way of thinking among the micro-historians. The micro-historians sought to recover the loss incurred by methods that look only for the homogeneous, the large scale, the comparable. The reduction of scale, they claim, permits in many cases a reconstitution of real life, unthinkable in other kinds of historiography. Now, that perhaps exaggerated insistence that real life is to be found only at the micro level does not, however, mean that the big questions of history have to be left aside. It's rather that the uniformity and necessity of the macro-historical developments is called in question by the study of ordinary human agency at the micro level. Now, it is a question whether the closeness to real life that micro-history pursues can really be claimed, can it really be said, as one of these historians claims, that microhistory conveys the lived experience to readers directly on the micro level of everyday life? Or another of them says that by focusing on the concrete and particular, microhistorical approaches often successfully evoke a vivid sense of lived human experience. Now, this is undoubtedly part of their wide appeal to a wide reading public. And as an aside at this point, we might say the same of the little stories in the Gospels, which seem to have just enough micro-historical detail to evoke a sense of the lived experience of people who interacted with Jesus. Doubtless this should be put down to skilled narration reflective of real experience. On the other hand, the philosopher Paul Ricoeur, who is generally favourable to microhistory, insists, quote, "What we do not see and must not expect to see is the lived experience of the protagonists. What we see is social interactions." And this comes from a fundamental distinction that Ricoeur makes between history and memory. What characterizes memory, personal memory, is precisely the experience of reliving lived experiences. But history is representation. It doesn't give you that directly. What it gives you is a reconstruction on the basis of the evidence. But it seems to me there may be a middle way. When the historian's sources consist of the participant's memory of lived experience, when we are quite close, as it were, to the way the eyewitness is told the stories, in such cases we may come imaginatively closer to the lived experience of past people than we do in much other sorts of history. And one more aspect of this focus on human agency at the micro level is the focus on anomalous and discontinuous elements. The macro historical approach, you know, tends to sort of smooth everything over and give you the big developments. The micro historical approach gives you all sorts of things that are happening that don't seem really to fit in with those broad theories about what's happening on the macro scale. Microhistory, according to Ginsberg, has confronted the question of comparison with a different and, in a certain sense, opposite approach through the anomalous, not the analogous. Macrohistory works with the analogous, looking for things that are similar and build up a picture. Microhistory focuses on the non-analogous, the anomalous. It regards the occurrence of unusual, unexpected, anomalous material in the sources as more promising for historical reflection. And it problematizes the relationship between the results of historical study in the macroscopic sphere and the microscopic spheres. Ginsberg insisting that results cannot be just transferred from one level to the other, from macro to micro level or the other way around. Ginsberg recognizes the biggest problem that the study of microhistory poses is how the macrohistorical level and the microhistorical level are related. Now, when I look along the shelves in history sections of bookshops, it seems to me as though everyone is now doing microhistory. People who otherwise do traditional macrohistory of all sorts are also writing small-scale studies of places, local events, persons of insignificant persons from the macrohistorical point of view. Such historians do not use the term microhistory or acknowledge any debt to the proponents of microhistory, and one wonders why. Is this a tribute to the influence of the microhistorians? Microhistory has become so mainstream that it needs no justification. People just do it without explanation. Or is it also perhaps that these historians, like most conventional historians, are pretty unreflective about the theory and method of historiography? Well, I leave that question. Let's turn back to the Gospels. And my heading here is the Gospels as microhistory? Now, let's return to the literary genre of the Gospels as ancient biography. And Richard Burridge, among his features of the genre of ancient biography that he discusses in order to test the Gospels for fit, is the matter of scale. Bioy, he says, biographies are written on a narrow scale, limiting the focus to the individual subject. And the Gospels obviously very readily fit this feature of biography. They all, he says, restrict their scale to the person of Jesus in a manner typical of Bios literature. As I've mentioned before, the ancients themselves distinguished between history and biography, and the point about biography is that it is written on a smaller scale. It can take an interest in matters that are not important at the macro scale, but which are important if one wishes to get to grips with a particular human life. Now, the way this works for Plutarch, for example, who expounds on this, the way this works for Plutarch depends on his understanding of biography as teaching by example. So this is very different from the microhistorians, really. It's a kind of moral purpose in writing biography to, as it were, set up the biographies as examples. And the small-scale things, the details of everyday life and things like that reveal the character, the habits, the approaches of a person with whom a reader might take as an example to follow. There was a very widespread interest in anecdotes about famous or wise people. Actually, in elementary education in rhetoric, you would learn how to tell anecdotes because they were a standard part of ancient discussion. Anecdotes are microhistory of a sort, and the Synoptic Gospels, as you know, contain many of them. The stories that the former critics called pronouncement stories, we would call anecdotes. And although these anecdotes, these little stories about Jesus, are not, I think, told primarily to make Jesus an example for emulation, they are, I think, indispensable to the way the Gospels portray Jesus and his activity. The stories of the Syrophoenician woman, or the Gerizim demoniac, for example, they're not just illustrations of something we could say in very general terms about Jesus, and that would be just as satisfactory. The particularity of these little stories, with their own puzzling or provocative features, contribute uniquely, irreplaceably, I think, to the understanding of Jesus that the Gospels give us. We need the microhistory. God is in the detail. Now, the reduction in scale that Plutarch adopted for his biographies did not, of course, as we know, entail any movement down the social scale. The subjects of the biographies are the same top people as the ones that are the sole actors in the macro history of the ancient world. Gospels, on the other hand, as we now know, are biographies that are also history from below, in which the agency of ordinary people comes into view, as it does hardly anywhere else in ancient historical literature. And the Gospels are made up, to a large extent, of little stories about little people whose lives, but for their connection with Jesus, would never have been noticed. In this sense, from the perspective of macro history, the macro history of that time, the Gospels bring to light anomalies that challenge dominant meta-narrative of the Greco-Roman historians. Just as modern micro-history keeps its distance from the dominant historical syntheses at the macro level, attending with care to the small scale, not in order to confirm the macro-historical accounts, but in order to understand the real life that tends to get ignored in the macro-historical accounts, so the Gospels work from below and show, in fact, that this is where history is really being made, among the common people, in ways that the dominant meta-narrative cannot recognize or assimilate. Like microhistory, the Gospel stories are often sharply discontinuous, disrupting the continuities of history. They're full of a sense of the astonishingly novel, the puzzling, and the provocative. Now, of course, as we also know, the Gospels do set their microhistory within a sort of meta-narrative of their own, or a better way of putting it, they set their microhistory within the biblical meta-narrative of the histories and prophecies of the Hebrew Bible. But before considering that meta-narrative, it's well worth noticing that the little stories in the Gospels retain, as it were, their micro-historical integrity despite the framework of meta-narrative in which the Gospels place them. For example, as Gerd Tyson has pointed out, although the Gospels, including sayings of Jesus, interpret his healings and exorcisms as signs or even concrete instances of the coming of the kingdom of God, this interpretation of them is scarcely visible at all in the way the synoptic gospels actually tell the stories of the healings and exorcisms. It's as though the stories reflect the immediate impact the events had on those who were there, but nothing more. Perhaps even more remarkable, it seems to me, are the stories of the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances. Apart from Matthew's apocalyptic earthquake, there's really nothing in these stories to indicate the uniquely eschatological significance of these events. There's none of the early Christian theology of resurrection, such as we read in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul cites the resurrection stories and then goes on to relate them to the grand narrative of universal resurrection. So again, it's as though the stories of the empty tomb confine themselves to what the women saw and understood at the time. Skillfully crafted though they are, the stories retain their character as pure micro-history, betraying hardly anything of the macro-historical or meta-narratival significance that is given them only in the broader gospel narratives within which they are placed. They have certainly not been generated by the meta-narrative. Rather, they're allowed to speak for themselves in their own particular way that is not replaced but encompassed by the meta-narrative that develops their universal significance. The peculiarity of the Gospels, from this point of view, is that their micro-historical character is fully consonant with the larger meta-narrative of which they form the historical climax. Or, to put it the other way around, the climax to this meta-narrative, to the story in which the God of Israel is on the way with his people to the fulfillment of his purpose for the whole world, is entirely appropriately this micro-history from below that we find in the Gospels. This is the way of the God of Israel. It's the way of the God who made a bunch of slaves his special people and acts always in the particular for the sake of the rest, and acts with the lowly people for the sake of all people. This God's purpose takes effect at the grassroots of history, where he works with people of all kinds, however unimportant in macro-historical perspective, down to the outcasts and the eradicated, in the little events that make their history The micro-historical people and particulars of the little stories of the Gospels have universal potential. They're representative of all who will encounter God in Jesus. In a sense, they are the meta-narrative. They are the mustard seed, proverbially smaller than all the seeds of the earth, that at the consummation of history will appear as the cosmic tree whose branches have room for all the birds of the air to nest in them. These gospel stories are a micro-historical counter-narrative to all the meta-narratives of power, including the one contemporary with the Gospels, the Roman one. The historiographical embodiment of the Roman meta-narrative goes back most notably to Polybius, and also, as we know, the most methodologically scrupulous of ancient historians, but also the first totalizing historicist. Polybius, his great work in 40 books, told the story of Rome's rise to dominate the Mediterranean world. He considered it the first properly universal history, because only from the date at which his narrative properly began, which was 220 BC, did the political affairs of all the nations begin to be interwoven in a movement towards a single goal. Here are the beginnings of that modernist paradigm of history, where history is seen as all one thing with a coherent direction and goal. So Polybius was able to claim that his subject was a single, unified one, and that his own history accurately mirrored the events. For just as Rome subsumed individual nations, so Polybius's history subsumed all other forms of history. Polybius actually disdains any history less universal than his own. So universal history, the idea of a history that integrates everything into an intelligible whole. So if you read the historian, you get this grand plan, you can see how everything fits together, you can understand it, it's rationally perceptible. That originates most especially, I think, with Polybius. And, of course, in Polybius's form, it's history from above. It's the military and political power of the ruling elites that, as it were, controls history and drives it in this single direction. It's also, in Polybius's view, determined by fate. Now, I'm reminded of the philosopher Karl Popper's savage critique of modern historicism. His critique of those grand narratives that claim to understand the laws and patterns of history and integrate everything into a process with a single goal. One of Popper's complaints was that such meta-narratives exalt the history of political power, which is one form of history, one aspect of human life, to the status of world history. Political history subsumes all other history, as though all people were to find their own goals fulfilled in political power. In reality, and you need to remember that he's writing this in 1945, in reality, he says, the history of power politics is nothing but the history of international crime and mass murder. Popper also rejects any sort of theistic concept of the meaning and goal of universal history. And he writes this very interesting passage. He says, to maintain that God reveals himself in what we commonly call history is indeed blasphemy. If history concerned itself with the forgotten, the unknown, the lone individual, his sorrow, his suffering, his death, for that is the true experience of people through the ages, then I would certainly not wish to claim that it is blasphemy to see the finger of God in it. Exactly. God is not in the power politics of Roman domination, in which Polybius saw the hand of fate, but in the gospel's micro-history from below, among the forgotten and the unknown, and present in the suffering and death of the abandoned Jesus. It's a story that resists integration into the history of power politics, but it has its own kind of universality and its own kind of power in history. Now, in the time I have left, I want to move on to the challenge of postmodernism, which has become very much a feature of modern historical debate, contemporary historical debate in the recent period. At this point, I'm very conscious of not doing justice to the material. It ought to have at least another couple of lectures, I think, to really grasp the challenge of postmodernism and respond to it and apply that to thinking about the Gospels. But I'll try and do this very briefly, just to give you at least a pointer in the direction that we may be thinking. Now, with postmodernism, and as most people consider it, postmodernism is closely connected with relativism and subjectivism, we come to an intellectual approach that poses the most radical question that could ever be put to the practice of history. in what sense do we really know anything about the past? Do historians recover the past, or do they construct it? Can we really distinguish historiography from historical fiction? It's perhaps not surprising that many, probably most historians, have resisted the influence of postmodernism in their field of study. And just to tie things together a bit, microhistory, of course, is very traditional in that sense of continuing the attempt to understand what was actually happening, the objectivism, if you like, of the modernist paradigm. The historian really is getting at what happened in history. The scale is different for microhistory, but the epistemology is not different. And the microhistorians consciously did not engage with the postmodern epistemological relativism. Postmodernism, however, challenges the very possibility of genuinely representing in historiography what actually happened. It challenges this possibility with its claim that language does not refer to reality but constructs it. Texts, including all sorts of historical evidence, are non-referential. So historians do not discover the past, they create it. This is the crisis of representation. And I think were the postmodern position to be accepted without qualification, this really would certainly mean the end of history. See, at least the end of traditional academic history, but surely also the end of any kind of history that would be distinguishable from fiction. The effect of the postmodern challenge is certainly to bring history closer to literature than it had been in the modernist paradigm. Historians had been used to distinguishing their scientific pursuit of factual truth from literature. But postmodernism's epistemological challenge to all the humanities took root most easily and fruitfully in literary studies. And it was from these, via the study of narrative, that postmodernism most impacted history. What is happening when historians construct narratives about the past? Which, of course, they have never stopped doing, despite social scientific approaches and so forth. The stuff of history still largely consists of constructing narratives about the past. Few historians have seriously supposed that their narratives reproduce what happened in history in some sort of photographic way, as though we had, you know, a video recording of what happened in history. Narratives are representations of what happened. In Paul Ricoeur's terms, they stand for the past. But traditional historians do suppose that their narratives are constructed from and constrained by the evidence, and therefore correspond to the past in ways that can be debated, refuted, and confirmed by study of the evidence. Historical narrative differs from fictional narrative in this reference to the past and in its accountability to the evidence. The postmodern treatment of historical narrative, for which Hayden White's work is best known and influential, dissolves this distinction between historical and other narratives. Historians employ the same narrative forms and structures as fictional writers do, and construct narratives for rhetorical purposes as others do. The critical point is the contention that narrative is a textual imposition on reality. After all, says Hayden White, no one lives a story. In reality, if postmodernist epistemology permits anything to be said about reality, the past is not a narrative. By creating a narrative, the historian invents the past. White complains of, quote, the reluctance of traditional historians to consider historical narrative as what narratives as what they most manifestly are, verbal fictions, the contents of which are more invented than found, and the forms of which have more in common with their counterparts in literature than they have with those in the sciences. Now, any of you who've had who have observed trends in biblical studies since the rise of postmodernism will recognise that it's really at this point in the assimilation of history to creative literature that new thinking about historiography has been influential in Gospels studies. I think it's rather a pity that this one of many fruitful new directions in recent historiography should have been the only substantial influential trend to affect biblical studies. But the reason is again actually partly to do with the proximity of various academic specialisms. Postmodernism came to biblical studies as it did to history from academic literary studies. It coincided with the literary turn that biblical studies had already taken, in the sense that people had become interested in the way the stories are told, the literary forms, and the literary skill and so forth of the gospel narratives. As a result, it is common to find biblical scholars regarding the gospels fundamentally as fictional constructs, in a way that gives postmodern sanction and a literary theoretical overtone to the already existing scepticism about the historical value of the Gospels. Now, to engage with postmodernist epistemology is a task well beyond the scope of these lectures, especially at this stage of them. But briefly, I think that for historiography to adopt a thoroughgoing postmodernist epistemology would really be historiographical suicide. We would be left with supposing that we really cannot know anything significantly about the past. But I also think that historiography should emerge from the engagement with postmodernism chastened and more theoretically self-aware. And to the postmodern challenge, I should like here and now to make four claims about historiography, which engage with the kind of things that postmodern writers are observing about historiography. I've got to do this far too briefly and sketchily, but here are my four points. First, I would say history is different from fiction. And here I have a really heavyweight ally in the philosopher Paul Ricoeur, whose last major work, published in 2004, was a study of historiography. It's called Memory, History, Forgetting. Ricoeur was known, certainly in biblical studies, primarily for his very influential study of fictional narrative called Time and Narrative, which he wrote at a much earlier stage of his very productive career. But he says that he had always intended to supplement this study of fictional narrative with a study of historiography. And he makes a clear distinction between fictional narrative and historiography. And he insists, this is one of the values of, it's a very rich and interesting book, but one of the values of his book is his insistence that historiography intentionally refers to historical reality. And this distinguishes it decisively from fiction. It intentionally refers to historical reality. That's what makes it historiography. So history is different from fiction. He also has a lot to say about how historians treat historical evidence and the methods of writing history and all kinds of things which are different from the way fictional writers work. But the sort of central point that's just obvious, but it's so important, is that someone who writes historiography intends to refer to historical reality. So it's the difference between intending to tell someone what you were doing yesterday and just making up an imaginative story. Secondly, human experience does, I think, have an irreducibly sequential and therefore narrative form. Contrary to Hyde and White, there is a sense in which we do live stories. We experience events by narrativizing our experience. Actually, not even just subsequently, but while we are experiencing events, we are actually narrativizing them in our minds. So when we tell stories about what has happened, we are not simply imposing narrative form on reality, even though we are, in a sense, creating the story that we tell. I think an interesting point that comes through to me out of the whole trend of what I've been doing in this lecture is that micro-history, micro-historical narratives actually seem to me to be closest to the narrative form of our experience. It's in these little stories, the small-scale events, that the narratives reflect most closely what it's like to experience history. The macro-historical narrativizations, we can't do without them, but they're rather more in the way of constructions, creative constructions informed by the evidence. But I think at the micro-historical level, we really do get we really are in contact with the way that we experience life as narrative. My third point is that history is not fiction, but it is a literary representation of the past. This is where I think the postmodernists have made a valid point to this extent. History is a literary representation of the past. As such, it's hardly surprising that it often emplots its narrative in forms that it shares with imaginative literature. Even in informal oral communication, telling each other stories about what has happened, we employ narrative conventions. We don't think about them, but they're conventions that we've simply picked up in our experience, and we use conventions just as we use linguistic conventions of all kinds in all sorts of communication. Having conventional ways of referring to things and talking about things doesn't mean that we're not conveying truth. It means that this is how human communication of truth has to happen. I've already mentioned the anecdote, which was beloved of the ancients and also, it seems, of the gospel authors as a micro-historical literary form. The anecdote offered a fairly flexible form for reporting, for example, someone's clever saying in response to a question or a situation. Now, an anecdote of that kind undoubtedly simplifies reality. It has to do so. But it also communicates history. Literary representation of the past employs literary forms such as those we can identify in the Gospels, and often, of course, it has rhetorical ends in view, in addition to the intentionality of referring to the past. All this is important, but it doesn't negate the character of history as literary representation of the past. And finally, this is a point I really would like to develop further if I had the opportunity. My last point is that history is perspectival. And here is where we can perhaps most profit from considering critically the postmodern challenge. History is perspectival. We cannot take a God's eye view of history, as though we were not in ourselves situated in the world. We can't, as someone has described it, take the view from nowhere. We ourselves are situated in the here and now, and so it is from somewhere in particular that we view the past. We are situated subjects, and we can view history only from a particular perspective in our present. This is not a renunciation of any sort of objectivity. for our perspectives are perspectives on something. Historical work is a constant attempt to represent the past in ways that best accord with the evidence. Nonetheless, for reasons to do with the complexity and the otherness of history, its resistance to anything like total comprehension, as well as the constraints and opportunities of the present contexts in which we do history, all history is perspectival. We construct interpretative representations of history which can tell at best only part of the story. Since that is the case, we shall surely come closest to past reality if we take account and advantage of a plurality of perspectives from the past, including a plurality of perspectives from witnesses, the witnesses on whom we depend for their first-hand reports of what happened. So in a final way in which the Gospels come closer to some recent approaches to historiography than to the ancient or the modernist paradigm is in their very plurality, in their multiplicity of perspectives, in the multivocality of the canon of the four Gospels. If we take the idea of perspectival history seriously, then the fact that we have four different Gospels need not be an embarrassment, as it quite often has been to Christians thinking about this in the past. It need not be an embarrassment, but a genuine advantage. We know Jesus the better for being able to adopt, as it were, these four different perspectives on Jesus that derive from the testimony of people who knew him. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. All right, so again, we do have a few minutes for questions related to this lecture, or really anything of the last couple of days, if you'd like. We'll just take about 10 minutes for that. I have a lot of things I'd like to ask, but I'll just ask one kind of sideways question. Many of us have read with benefit, of course, Tom Wright's work, such as New Testament People of God, and it sort of came to mind for me a couple times, and then the question, where would you place the kind of work he does within today's historiography? It's kind of an interesting sideways question, particularly his focus on, at the one time, it's sort of history from below in the sense that he's seeking to reconstruct what the average first century Jewish person would believe, even to the point of what Jesus' mindset would be, which may be a bit much in my opinion, but at the same time it's still sort of broad swath, so I wonder how you might evaluate Tom's work there.
I mean, there are two points worth making. I mean, in his first volume in the series, I've forgotten what the first one was called, but he sort of expounded his methodology and he adopts what he calls critical realism.
Right.
Which I think is one way of recognizing, actually, you know, the fact that we don't have a view from nowhere. It's a sort of chastened objectivity, I think, is the point. It's not denying objectivity, but nor is it denying the influence of subjective and perspectival aspects to our knowledge of the past. So that's his kind of philosophical epistemological approach. So it's not quite how I would say it, I don't think, but it chimes reasonably well with the sort of thing I was saying. And of course, he is responding in his own way to the postmodern sort of challenge to history. The other point is that he does have a very explicit historical methodology, which is roughly that the historian is in the business of constructing a broad theory, which is tested against its ability to account for all the evidence. And so that's what he does, you know, in his book about Jesus in particular, his idea about return from exile, the kingdom of God, the role of Israel, and what he's all the time doing is trying to show that the detail of the Gospels fits this broad hypothesis. He doesn't sort of claim that the Gospels themselves set out this hypothesis, I don't know. This is a historian's hypothesis, and he's asking whether it accounts for the Gospel material as a kind of historical construct. I find myself wondering whether it isn't perhaps too grand and generalizing a theory, and whether we don't need more attention to the micro-historical detail. It would seem to me better if one were to look at these little stories, at the sayings of Jesus, in themselves. I mean, you can't divide sort of context that you're exploring from the detail, but I do get, I mean, it's partly, you know, the kind of way people think, and Tom Wright is, you know, a thinker of big ideas. I mean, that's really what he's good at, and setting out these grand things. I don't say it's not very valuable, but I think my response would be, let's do a little bit more of the micro-history and test the grand theories more, root the grand theories more, more closely in the micro-historical detail that the Gospels do give us.
Dr. Bauckham, thank you for your lectures. In light of all four of your lectures, how would you say the social status and sort of this historical perspective on what the Gospels are, how would you say that affects how we answer the question, what is the Gospel in general, and how the Gospels tell us what is the Gospel?
Okay, the Gospel in the sense of the Gospel message, the correct message that Christians have for the world. what a good question. I do think that sometimes people's understanding of what the Gospel we have to proclaim is, again, rather cuts loose, I think, from the real content of the Gospels, you know. It tends to take its bearings from the summaries, and you know, the New Testament itself has a whole lot of summaries of the Gospel message, and we do need those; they're important. But I think we also need to realise that they are kind of summaries of what we've got in the Gospels. And if the Gospel has something to do with the kingdom of God, you know, the Gospels go into all this detail to try and show us what the kingdom of God involves, what Jesus was about, and all those kind of things. And therefore, perhaps it's again a question of the general and the particular. But I think we always need to be bringing back the general, the summaries, the abstract. We always need to be bringing them back to all this kind of concrete, detailed stuff that we've actually got in the Gospels. And it's an interesting question, of course, to what extent were any of the Gospels composed with evangelistic intentions? And my answer to that tends to be that you wouldn't really expect in the first century that these books would come into the hands of unbelievers just like that. If they came into the hands of unbelievers, it would be via Christians. So really, I think it's quite likely the Gospels were used in explaining to unbelievers what Christian faith was all about and who Jesus was and everything, but they'd be used in a sort of context of, you know, Christians in who have friends who are not Christians and so on reading these things together. It would be that sort of an exercise. But again, I mean, if that is true, and I think it's really quite a good reason for thinking that is true, then again, the unbeliever isn't just being given, you know, the very bald message, God so loved the world that he gave his only son. I mean, it's a great summary. But they are being given all this detail. They can build up a picture of the sort of person Jesus was, all these kinds of things. And the other thing is, of course, the evangelistic sermons in Acts are rather interesting because, again, the standard evangelistic sermon in Acts is a sort of summary of the gospel story. And in a way, I mean, particularly Mark looks like a sort of expansion of one of those summaries of the gospel story. It's notable, they always begin with John the Baptist, and that's where, sort of standard way of starting the story, where Mark starts. with John the Baptist. And one can imagine, you know, obviously the sermons in Acts are very brief sort of abstracts of what anyone would actually have said. One can imagine them filling out that sort of summary with concrete stories from the Jesus tradition before there were Gospels, but they knew these stories. And so, you know, again, that the sort of summary of the Gospel story is filled out, given substance by particular narratives. And I do think in the end, you know, in a secular society trying to communicate the Gospels, one thing one can come back to is that actually the figure of Jesus in the Gospels is an enormously appealing and attractive figure. Just reading the Gospels itself often has real impact on people. So let's not just say, you know, Jesus came to give us salvation. Let's try and give people some of this sense of who Jesus was, which comes out in all this stuff in the Gospels. And therefore, of course, who Jesus was is who Jesus is. So I suppose I come back to saying, let's tell the story of Jesus in more detail as kind of essential to proclaiming the Gospel.
Perhaps this is a related question to the end of how you were answering Chris's question. Genre is usually critical to understanding what a certain text is saying. Like, if you don't understand something's a parable, then you're going to misunderstand it. How does understanding the Gospels as at the intersection of ancient historiography and biography affect the everyday reading of the Gospels?
That's a good question, a very big question. As you say, one has to start somewhere with any piece of literature in terms of what sort of thing one thinks it is, you know. And nowadays, you know, if we read a historical novel, we know it's not academic history, and so, you know, things are quite sort of, you know, you start off. What I'm trying to say is that you need a general concept of genre, of what sort of thing this is. And then, of course, the actual narrative can be quite surprising. It can, innovate in terms of the way the genre is being used. But you need a sort of starting point in some general sense of what sort of literature this is to get going. And then the thing can, it takes its own, follows its own way and can lead you in directions you may not have been expecting. So I think that the basic idea that the Gospels intend to recount the past history of Jesus, they are about what happened in history, combined with some understanding of how, in their historiographical context, one actually told history. In other words, for example, these are points that Burridge makes, I think, quite helpfully, you wouldn't expect a biography necessarily to be chronological. It's quite within the range of how people wrote history to group things topically. I mean, Lucian's History of the Philosopher Demonax is almost entirely a collection of anecdotes which could as well come in any order as any other order. You know, there's very little chronological structure. And chronology doesn't really matter in what order Jesus performed a series of miracles. So sometimes the Gospels are composed with topical forms of organization. There's an overall chronological structure, but there's a fair bit of other things going on in terms of how they're organized within that. These kind of details which arise, but people do, you know, notice the differences between the Gospels and, you know, what's going on when Mark's story is told slightly differently by Matthew and Luke. And I think one thing that's really important to remember, actually, is that all historians in the ancient world had to tell engaging stories. They had to be good storytellers. And so the way that a story is narrated it's not just, you know, this kind of video of what happened. It's a communication of what happened to the reader. It's got to engage the reader, involve them in the story, and all those kinds of things. And if you look at the differences between Matthew and Luke and Mark, where they're parallel, you can see that they exercise a certain freedom in how they tell the story. That would not have surprised any ancient reader. You know, there's a degree of freedom in how you tell the story that's expected of a storyteller. So I think once people recognize how ancient historical writing had to be storytelling, and that a degree of freedom in details was perfectly expected and no one would trouble themselves about it, means that the differences between the Gospels, which people sometimes get very worried about, are actually nothing to worry about. They're only what one might expect.